Okay, so the US is running very poor foreign policy, which it is. It's militarily looking weaker and weaker and unable to even deal with a bunch of bandits like the Houthis, which is true. And now we're just going to cut rates back to zero and let everything rip with a crazy fiscal deficit. And by the way, you know, we don't expect you to all buy every commodity possible as a hedge against that. We don't think anyone will do that. I mean, I'm being sarcastic. No, this is a crazy...
Welcome back to Soar Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Soar Financial Group. Really appreciate you joining us here because we have a first-time guest on the program. It's been a while since we've invited somebody new on the channel, and I'm really looking forward to some fresh ideas and some fresh thinking. It's Michael Avery. He's the global strategist at Rabobank. Really looking forward to this discussion because he's based in Singapore as well. So it's a bit of a different perspective probably on things as well, and we've got lots to discuss. It's Super Bowl Monday. We're recording this year, so it's been fairly quiet on the macro front this morning. Seems like everybody's watched the game, or Michael told me it's also Chinese New Year, but we're way too U.S. focused in the reporting on the economy side, so let's go with Super Bowl Monday hangover and quiet news front. But that lets us allows us to let the dust or comb through the dust a little bit, see what's stuck from the last 10 days, because we got so much macro news. We got the FOMC meeting about 10 days ago. We got non-farm payrolls and much, much more. Let's see what's stuck. How important is everything and where is it going? Let's discuss with Michael, and it's great to welcome him on the program. Michael, thank you so much for joining me here.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, let's set the scene a little bit. I always like starting with a bit of a ground setting question here. Like, where are we at in the economy? Like, how is the economy doing right now? How do you feel right now, Michael?
How do I feel right now? Well,
how do you feel about things? So
I always feel nervous personally about things and about life in general. Anyone who knows me will tell you that. But in all seriousness, we're at a very, very interesting juncture because exactly where we're going isn't clear, but the range of parameters within which we could be operating in the fairly near future is quite incredible. Like the tail risks to the left of us and the tail risks to the right of us, they're both really quite extreme. And the market is looking at scenarios where, you know, things could be a minus two, things could be a plus two, and they're trying to hope they're going to net out at zero. And I think that's probably the least likely scenario. Things could be, you know, very much in the negative or very much in the positive, but it's unlikely to be this happy, healthy, you know, we all have a happy, we all live happily ever after ending, which is what's currently being priced for or had been until recently.
I've mentioned to you before hitting record, I'm sensing a bit of a sentiment change overall, also the tone of the financial reporting, like Bloomberg, for example, where even the bears are starting to change their tone, saying, hey, maybe this is a bit of a trampoline economy. It's not as bad as we think it will be, like the soft landing or the hard landing scenarios are maybe too extreme. Let's talk about no landing to, a rebound trampoline effect. Do you agree with that at all? Like, where's that sentiment change coming from?
Well, the data, obviously, when you get payrolls in particular coming out as strongly as it did in January, and you know that the central banks have to rely on that, even if they hold their nose while doing it, it's very hard to be negative. In fact, if you look at the momentum that you've had, particularly on that front in the US labor market, although, again, as I said, there are question marks over every data point on how it's being measured. And then you look at the inflation in the ISM services print, which was 64 on the prices paid, which is really, really, you know, strong. It doesn't look like an economy that's about to fall over, or if it is about to fall over, from the pace of jobs growth that you have now to a negative jobs growth, which would be when you get really aggressive Fed cuts, which is what some people want to see, you would have to see it absolutely go off of a cliff. Now, can that happen? Well, absolutely. There are various different triggers that could mean that, but you are going from, as I said, this plus two scenario to minus two straight away without having anything like zero in between. So it's a really, really uncertain situation. And I think people are just scrambling, mainly by looking backwards at data rather than looking forwards and trying to parse that data and look at the underlying fundamentals and just, you know, rushing to adjust. But I think the most important thing to try and do through all of this is really understand that there is one big disconnect right now that has to be ironed out of the market as things stand today before we go anywhere else. And that is that as of the beginning of this year, we had nearly 7 Fed cuts penciled in, which is really pretty aggressive. And the Fed has made it very, very clear the most we're likely to get is 3. And that's if everything goes completely smoothly. And in the last 6 weeks, the complete opposite has happened. Everything has actually looked pretty hot rather than cold. And if anything, you would say the Fed should be hiking from here rather than talking about cutting. So that's the first disconnect that we have to unravel before we go anywhere else. And it's partly that that explains people scrambling to suddenly say, oh, maybe there's a soft landing. Maybe there is no landing. Maybe there's a trampoline. They're catching up to that reality. You can't price for 7 cuts with this kind of data backdrop. You can't.
No, exactly. Like, because the first rate cut was projected to be in May as well. So timing wise, the data can't change as quickly as people now expect it, or the market partially expected it to be.
Well, sorry to jump in there, Kai. Some people were saying March. You even had a few people taking a punt on January. I mean, there were some voices saying maybe even in January. I mean, what people were smoking to think they were going to cut in January, I don't know, but they were.
No, absolutely. They were probably betting as well that Travis Kelce probably go down on his knee during the Super Bowl and propose to Taylor Swift as well. Same kind of bettors, I think, right? But talking about the disparity, like and the data, because the data has been somewhat consistent. We've always had a strong jobs market. So is it just timing or the time passed that sort of convinced the bears and is turning the bears into bulls now as well? Is that okay? We've seen proof is in the pudding. We've seen the numbers stay stable in the especially the jobs market. Is that what convinced the bears to turn into bulls? Is just well, time?
Look, let me give you my view on that. I've been doing this job in various different forms for various different people for nearly 25 years. And there are people out there who really, really pass the data. You know, when you get a payrolls report in particular, they absolutely look at changes to the methodology. They look at all the regional breakdowns. They look at the seasonally adjusted and unseasonally adjusted. They look at any kind of aberrations that might be going into it, all different ways to slice and dice it. And you put that together with other ways of looking at things and you can project a pattern, you know, in what you think is going to be happening going forward. The vast majority of people just look at the number on their Bloomberg screen when it comes out, or maybe even just in the financial media, and just take the headline and that's it. That's where a lot of people who, you know, who are trading or moving money around, you know, are in that particular argument. And of course, you're going to get a disconnect between someone who just looks at a headline and someone who says, well, hang on, what's payrolls growth doing relative to population growth? So what's your real payrolls, which is what I look at, you know, adjusted for population. Is that positive or is that negative or is that flat? What are we doing in terms of these seasonal adjustments? What are we doing in terms of the birth death model, which assumes that jobs are being created in new sectors? How are we lining that up with all the list of layoffs that we're seeing in different sectors? How are we combining that with the fact that the housing market hasn't rolled over yet, amazingly, and so construction is still really strong? And normally, you know, the construction sector, when you see jobs turning down there, the payroll sector as a whole turns down. How do you slice and dice all of that? And that's, I think, where you're starting to get divergent voices emerging, because you can paint a scenario where we just keep rolling on, particularly if the government keeps spending money, we just keep rolling on. You can also paint a very realistic scenario where we do suddenly go off of a cliff. We get these massive adjustments where we realize that actually the hypothesized version of the labor market that we see from the Bureau of Labor Statistics actually doesn't match up to the reality, and suddenly everything's revised hugely, which we get backwards all the time. And then the market scrambles to adjust. And both of those are realistic scenarios. So we are all collectively, you know, fumbling around and trying to guess what we think is going to go forward. So it's not just that consistency. It's how deeply you look at it and how broadly you try and drag it into other patterns and link it to other patterns to project forward.
It feels like we're too binary. We look at mostly the US data. We seem to ignore a lot of the rest. I mentioned that in my intro. It's like it's very US focused. Even me just saying, well, it's Super Bowl Monday. Nobody's at the office because everybody's taking a day off. But you said, well, Chinese New Year. And I think we need to look more broadly, right? I think that's a perfect example as well. Are we being too, how would you call it, like narrow-minded to a degree? Like, do we just look at too much of the simple data? Like, we keep discussing the US, but we don't discuss geopolitics. We will later, but overall, like, taking that into consideration, like, is that what is happening? Is it just really too focused on the US?
Of course we are. I mean, of course we are. I mean, again, after 25 years of doing this, I have many, many contacts that I either work with directly or who I'm, you know, aware of and, you know, following the market, who have the very highest intellect and the, you know, the very, very deepest passion for really trying to understand what's going on. most people just want to make money, understandably. And it doesn't matter what's going on to them. They'll just follow any trend, any headline, you know, any rushing crowd, just if they think there's a smell of money in that direction. So the conversation is very, very heavily weighted towards a not very deep, global, thoughtful framework, shall we say, and very, very heavily weighted towards what's going on in the US in the next 30 seconds. And yeah, again, you can make a lot of money doing that, but it doesn't necessarily give you a good tell on what's actually going to be happening at turning points. And you're right, geopolitics is a huge part of that. But let me just throw in one very simple point, if I may. When we're having this discussion about the US, I can talk, you know, in detail without being a US analyst about some of these problems that you have with the quality of the data, because I have covered the US in the past. And many other people can do that too. What you have to do, I think, when you are looking at a really uncertain situation like that, is what's going on in other similar economies. And here the interesting point is you have incredibly low unemployment and ostensibly strong labor markets, ostensibly, in almost every developed economy. So that's one kind of anchor that I can still hold on to, which is, okay, you might have questions about the quality of what's happening in the US, and they are valid. What about Canada? What about the UK? What about every major European economy? They're all seeing pretty much the same thing. So unless we start seeing a sharp differentiation between the US and the others, or all of them, you know, turning at the same time, I don't think we can dismiss completely the fact that there may be something new going on here that we don't know, unless all the stats agencies are talking to each other over the weekend and deciding that they're all going to revise their methodology dodgily in the same direction. And I wouldn't rule that out either, but no. I think it's unlikely.
I want to challenge you on that point just a little bit, because based in Germany, of course, we're officially, like, we barely skirted a recession, but the EU in general is in recession. I think we're down to 0.1% overall, like in 2023. Not enough of divergence from the US, because the US is growing by 5% apparently, like the latest GDP numbers here, if you want to believe that. So there is a 5%, you know, difference. Like the US is way ahead of the other G7 nations, for example. Right. Is it just also, like, maybe you want to throw in the energy policies as well to a degree that is making the US somewhat a leader among the G7 here?
Okay, well, let's dive into that very quickly. First of all, obviously, you have US outperformance in terms of the mega corporations, which are still based in the US, which are also driving its stock market performance. And, you know, and that clearly is something that Europe doesn't have. That's true. Then you also have larger fiscal stimulus in the US than you do in Europe. Europe is still wedded to this austerity policy, whether it admits it or not. And the only pockets of Europe where you are seeing decent growth in the periphery is because you are getting fiscal stimulus going in. It's not rocket science. That's what's driving it. And America is still seeing a lot of fiscal stimulus in the background that people don't necessarily recognize. Whether that's sustainable or not is a different question. And then lastly, yeah, you do have this energy policy, because energy is expensive in Europe, even if we're off the peaks. It's much, much cheaper in the US. And Germany in particular really is now facing up to the kind of headlines that I've been predicting for several years, which is deindustrialization and a hollowing out. And given that, you know, Germany is the heart of the European economy, where that leaves the European economy in the longer run is, you know, a really worrying question. But yeah, the US is outperforming, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it too couldn't potentially be about to go off of a cliff in some scenarios, even though I don't think that's where we are now. I'm just still saying that that is still the parameter of the spectrum of possibilities we have to accept.
We're jumping around a little bit, but I sort of want to circle back to the Fed and maybe next moves, and also quantitative tightening to a degree as well. Since you brought in, you know, fiscal stimulus here, sort of that's the buzzword I want to hang my head on for the next 10 minutes, maybe here. The conversation is like, what happens if the Fed really starts maybe lowering rates? What is the signal, and ends QT as well? Which apparently they're still tightening, but you're saying there's still a lot of fiscal stimulus. Okay. I'm mixing points because I'm mixing the Treasury and the Fed right now. And I've noticed that asking my question here as well.
But you're not the only one. The Treasury and the Trade
are, which is good.
Themselves.
Like, sometimes it's good to speak things out loud, and then you realize what you're actually saying. Right.
You're right. You are right. It's happening.
But, But let's talk about that as well. Like, there's two things. Like, fiscal stimulus is one thing. Like, we have the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act as well, that's still pumping a lot of money into the economy. But then on the other hand, you have the Fed that's saying, well, we got to tighten a bit more, and stimulus for the banks and other institutions needs to be tightened, right? So disincentivized as well. I think we need to talk about that. Like, why is there that divergence, and where do you see things headed? Like, the Inflation Reduction Act, CHIPS Act, is pumping money in while we're taking money out of the system on the other end. Where is that leading?
Okay, lots to unpack there.
I know.
And this all sits within the paradigm I just tried to underline, which is we don't know quite where we're going, that it could be a -2 or a +2, and everyone's trying to average it to 0, and that's the least likely to be where we are. Okay, so let's keep conversation moving within that framework. We do now have links between fiscal policy and monetary policy. Now, historically, that's not supposed to happen. That's a bit naughty. They're both supposed to operate to try and keep inflation low. Obviously, that changed during COVID, when for the first time, very concretely, we recognized that we can go back to past eras of effectively monetizing government debt and spending it directly into the economy. Because, you know, you can quibble about whether that did or didn't happen. I believe it did. Not everywhere and not all the time, but lots of places and for lots of the time. And what did we get? An enormous mini boom and inflation. So now we realize it's not such a good idea to do that into the consumer side, because we don't make much in the West anymore. And lo and behold, you get inflation. If you try and do that, you need to balance supply with demand, which is a whole separate conversation we can come to in a minute. But we are now seeing a much more political central bank in most places, in different ways, shapes or forms. For example, in Europe, you know, President Lagarde has been very geopolitical in her comments. And in other places, we're seeing a more politicized treasury starting to, you know, deliberately move into the area of monetary policy. I mean, for example, you never used to get the Treasury Secretary talking about monetary policy. Janet Yellen can't shut up. She still thinks she runs the Fed. And clearly there's tension between her and Powell. And you are right. Powell has been trying to run tight policy, and Yellen has been running incredibly loose fiscal policy, regardless of how she dresses it up. And there are various different technicalities you can get into in terms of, you know, the quarterly refunding announcement and how the yield curve may or may not be being played with, and the bills versus bond issuance ratio, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have to go into that long grass. The key thing is we are in an uncertain situation. No one's quite sure where we're going. There are lots and lots of, you know, fat tail risks to the left and the right. And I guess a lot of them we'll be discussing in a moment. And the central banks are trying to do the right thing. And the treasuries, or the finance ministers, are also generally trying to do what they think are the right thing, but they're not necessarily the same right things. And they're not helping each other a lot of the time. They're working against each other. And my broader thesis, by the way, is that ultimately the resolution here is that they will have to operate more closely together. And that's really going to shake the box even further in terms of the policy framework that we see. I think we're moving in that direction, but initially we're pulling in different directions rather than working together in the same.
And now we have the US elections in November as well this year. Let's throw that into the mix, because apparently the central bank and Powell's not supposed to be political. Yellen is, of course. So, and as you said, like, she's weighing in heavily, and she sort of relies on the Fed to a degree as well. Like, I know the Fed has stepped into certain bond auctions and picked up, you know, pieces here and there to help out. I haven't heard about it last week. So that's that big bond auction and that refinancing seemed to go through without a hitch. But let's throw in the U.S. elections here to complicate the matter as well. And I don't want to get political at all. I'm just curious, like, what the scenarios are and what potential outcomes might be here as well. Because it's in the near future. It's only 9 months away, pretty much. So that's not too long. It'll go by quickly. So what are your thoughts on that? And, like, how heavily politicized is the whole the monetary system and financial system going to get?
Hugely. I think the market is waking up to that to a degree. Because at the moment, even though everything can change, the market is starting to say, okay, it's Biden-Trump 2.0. That looks like the rematch. It's not a rematch anyone's particularly excited about, but there you go. But what that implies for markets really is very, very important, because let's take the continuity camp. Let's presume the candidate is Biden. Let's presume Biden wins. Well, are things going to get radically different 4 years more, you know, of what we've already had, or are they just going to be more of the same? If it's more of the same, the fiscal picture starts to look pretty uncomfortable. You know, the market would eventually start to react to that one way or another. The geopolitical and foreign policy picture also gets extremely complicated. But that's one set of risks for the market to be aware of. If we go the other route and we presume that the nominee is Trump, and we presume Trump wins, hypothetically, well, have you looked at his policies? And I'm asking because I was quite surprised. A lot of people I talk to in markets haven't seen what his policy platform is. It's pretty radical. I mean, he's talking about raising tariffs on China to over 60%, 6-0, putting a 10% tariff on the rest of the world, slashing taxation within America, particularly on production, to try and basically raise money through tariffs rather than domestically. That won't work, but it is a historical pattern that he's looking to. Use that ultra cheap energy in the US to try and make it even more beneficial to produce there. And he's even talking about using federal land grants to build 10 freedom cities, where basically, I mean, the land will just be given over to the private sector and everyone is told, go and build your house or your office building there, you know, build a new city. I mean, how you plan that, I don't know, but the concept is basically cheap building in 10 new locations.
Just to jump in there, just for clarification, is that like the tax-free zones we have in parts of Asia or so as well? Like,
it's unclear. But I think he's talking about giving them the land. Like, there is no cost of the land here, you just build. Well, how much is your house going to cost if you don't have to buy the land? Very little. So you are potentially talking about a staggering economic boom if there's 10 cities going on building all that. And who does the infrastructure? I don't know. It's a whole separate question. As ever with Trump, there are more questions than answers. But he's also talking about, you know, mass deportation of, you know, depending on the current politically correct terminology, you know, illegal aliens or unregistered workers, whatever you want to call them. Which would tighten the labor market very significantly. So if you put those together, you don't have to be much an analyst to say that's going to be incredibly inflationary and massively disruptive to the entire global system, whereby countries that are used to exporting to the US suddenly can't and have to find new markets for their products, whereas the US may potentially have either an inflationary boom where everything is onshored or an inflationary recession, where it doesn't, you know, it suffers the consequences of seeing the cost of everything being brought in go through the roof before it manages to shift production locally. So you have like a really bad crossover effect before you start making more. So when you look at it like that, the range of outcomes is huge, not just between Trump and Biden, but within Trump and then how Trump does or doesn't do things, how that plays out. And the market is continuing, to go back to my original point of saying, everything will be an average nice zero rather than plus two or minus two. I see very little possibility of that being the case.
Yeah, it's not black and white. Like, it's really interesting. It's very difficult. Like, but just to touch on what you mentioned, it sounds like there's a continuation of the deglobalization trend as well. Like, until like a few years ago, of course, everybody wanted to, you know, trade with everybody, and everything was honky-dory on the supply chain side. Everybody worked with everybody. It was fine. But that is, you know, turning into pockets, like east, almost east versus west. And even within the west, there are different pockets. Within the east, there are different pockets that don't necessarily agree with each other. Is that just a continuation of the trend? And Trump is just that radical that sort of expresses where we're headed anyway right now, just because of, let's call it, ideological thinking, east versus west?
Yes and no. I mean, this is an area I spend a lot of time in. I have done. For years, it's kind of one of my specialisms, and everything else that I look at flows back to this or flows from it, full disclosure. You know, Trump wasn't the driver of deglobalization, he was a symptom of it. It was already happening in other places, including in Asia, including in China, and Trump was a reaction to that from the American side. Globalization isn't dead per se. Being based in Asia, there is still increasing integration within the Asian region, for one. And you see the same thing in Africa, too. As infrastructure is built out, incomes rise, people travel and trade more, you are getting greater linkages and economies of scale in a globalized way within those regions. So lots of that is happening, and there's nothing saying that's going to stop. You're not going to have, for example, Thailand and Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam trade less together. No, more and more and more incrementally. But if you're talking cross-regionally, where the simple model was Asia makes everything, the West consumes everything, that's gone. That's finished. It's going to be slow to completely exit because it takes a long time to shift supply chains, and too many CEOs are incentivized to do nothing and then get a, you know, golden parachute and head out the door, rather than actually affect meaningful change within a time frame that can help in this particular environment. But politically, geopolitically, there is no longer any appetite, in centers of power, for the pattern of integrated economic globalization and financial globalization that we had up until a few years ago. And that's true on the Chinese side, just as it is on the American side and even on the European side. And so step by step, two steps forward, one step back, we will see the trend continue in that direction. Trump is likely to accelerate it, but he's not, as I said, the cause. He's the symptom.
Interesting. Like, this supply chain is a topic I want to touch on in a second as well. But just one thought that popped into my mind. Is there a bit of a substitution, or is there a substitution for China, for example? Everything was made in China in the past. That is changing, as you mentioned. Do you see another country or region sort of pick up the slack there, perhaps? I was thinking maybe India, because Apple, I think, shifted some of its production from China to India, for example. Do you see like a second China emerge from that as well? Is that a possibility even? I'm just trying to look like maybe that balances things out a little bit in the long run.
Well, a balance is an interesting word. I mean, we'll find a new form. I don't think balance, if I may, is a very good word, because we never had a balance before. We had one model which was extremely imbalanced, that we make everything, you consume everything.
Maybe like not shaking things up too much is maybe... I was meaning with that, right? Just keeping things as they were, right, by just adding a different partner to the equation to keep things maybe stable. Not balance is probably the wrong word, but stable, based on what we've had in the past.
Okay,
does that make sense? Yeah,
it does. Yes and no. If you take that viewpoint, the argument that supports that is that while we have had a great deal of diversification from China, which you can see in the data, and you can already see the winners are the likes of India and Mexico, in particular, Vietnam too. None of them are ever going to be a China. They can't be. They don't have the same policy platform of just produce. They don't have the same scale. Even India, it's more of a domestically focused economy than an export focused one. Now, China does have a large domestic economy, but it's also an enormous exporter. So we'll never replace China with a new China. India won't be it, Indonesia won't be it, Vietnam won't be it, nobody will be. So it will be a different pattern where you have more widely distributed and broadly distributed production and consumption, which is no bad thing, by the way. I don't like models where you have everything being done in one center and something else but only being done in one other. I think that's inherently dangerous and unstable. So that is going to happen. But even there, you can see periods of that being gentle and periods of that being rough. Like, let me give you an anecdote. For example, a few years ago, and even more the case now, I believe, I was hearing stories that Indian textile producers, their telephones were ringing nonstop with Western firms saying, look, we want to shift orders from China to you. And their response was, we can't produce any more than we are now because we don't have any looms. We've got all the workers, we don't have any looms. Can you guess who makes looms?
China.
Correct. So China wouldn't sell them because it didn't want to just basically shift the industry to India. So India, in this anecdote, and I'm not an expert in this field, someone may contradict me if they've got better data, but this was from someone who, had a connection who did. India said, right, well, we're going to have to basically make the looms ourselves. Now, to do that, you have to make every component part from the bottom up. So you have to shift everything from upstream, downstream supply chains in order to internalize that, domesticize it, then start rolling it out. And then, and only then, the Western companies can move en masse. rather than at the margin, because at the moment they're just moving at the margin. So that's what you call a J curve effect, where everything goes like that and then it rockets up the other way. And I think we're in that right now. I think everyone's saying, well, this is a gentle J curve. We can cope with this pace of change. You know, as a company, it's not battering me too much. Just wait. Just wait another couple of years.
Interesting. Yeah, let's stay on that topic, because I think part of that discussion needs to be supply chain. And we briefly talked before hitting the record button as well that we need to address the Red Sea situation right now, because it came and it sort of disappeared in the mainstream media again. Like, unless a ship gets attacked, you don't hear much about what is happening currently in that region, especially to the effect of supply chains. Of course, you hear when the U.S. is attacking 10 targets in Iran, you hear that, but you don't really hear about the supply chain side of things. Let's discuss that. And I proposed a question to you before we hit the record button. Not really sure where it fits into our discussion right now, since we're on the topic of geopolitics, but I wanted to ask if the Fed takes that into consideration at all, or should they, based on what is happening there? Because if a massive disruption happens there, supply chains get affected, inflation might skyrocket again. So that's sort of the line of thinking I had there beforehand. I'm trying to throw it in here. I'm trying to fit that question in, given the overall context, but curious to hear your thoughts there, Michael.
Sure. Well, look, you're absolutely right. I'll come to the Fed aspect in a moment, if I may. When we're talking about globalization, one other way in which we need to think of it is in terms of the physical aspect of it, the infrastructure, the logistics, because the way the world economy has worked up until recently is, first of all, whatever you make, you could integrate yourself wherever you were as an economy into a global supply chain, which ended up selling to America as the consumer of last resort. Maybe you didn't sell directly, maybe you sold indirectly, but at the end of the day, the American consumer with a credit card would just rock up and say, well, yeah, we're the ones who are going to buy it. Fantastic. You earn US dollars for it, you put them in the bank, everyone's happy. And in terms of how you physically got the stuff there, you got your stuff into a truck, you got it to a port, you got it onto a ship, and the ship would go to America. Now, during COVID, we already started to see that really run into deep problems. And in fact, I released a report called In Deep Ship at the time, underlining how people in the industry, if you listen to them, were screaming and saying, look, this is an overly concentrated market. And I coined the phrase too big to sail, you know, making a joke on the too big to fail banks, where you had too few mega large firms who were operating as a cartel, who were insisting on bigger and bigger ships, which are easier and easier to disrupt, going into fewer and fewer mega ports, which then force everyone else to build infrastructure, which can adapt to the scale of goods coming through them. And if they don't, then you end up with a traffic jam the second you get outside the port. And as soon as you get goods demand picking up, which is what we saw, you have inflation, which won't go away until goods demand drops off, which is kind of where we are now, finally, a few years later. But we haven't fixed anything on that front. Anyway, so that's the globalized backdrop. You could move stuff around until things went wrong if demand got ahead of supply. Well, what we're now seeing, going back to, you know, Ukraine, obviously with everything that happened in the Black Sea, tensions in the South China Sea and, you know, around Taiwan, and very evidently in the Middle East now with the Red Sea, with the Houthis, we are seeing, if you excuse the pun, the fact that maritime traffic, which we absolutely rely on, can and is being disrupted. So with nothing really going through the Suez Canal, or very little going through the Suez Canal, everyone's having to go around the Cape of Good Hope instead, around Africa. Now that's adding weeks to journey time. That means, you know, more fuel. It also means it absorbs a lot more capacity in container shipping to make sure that you can keep the same volume of goods arriving on a daily basis. We've got just about enough ships to do that, but it has already seen you know, container freight rates triple from around $1,500 to $4,500, which is nowhere near as high as they were during COVID, but tripling is still inflationary. But more importantly, we are seeing that the concept of an open global sea, which you can use to move goods from A to B, is starting to break down. Now, we haven't experienced that, not just for decades, but, you know, arguably for even longer than that, because the British tried to keep most of the sea open. And then post-World War II, it was the US. But we are starting to slide towards, we're not there yet, starting to slide towards a return to a world of empires where you have, you know, economic zones where only favored countries can bring their goods in. And if you're a small economy and you're not a favored economy, you can't get your goods there, or you have to pay a very, very high de facto tariff to get your product there. This is a political or a geopolitical world that most CEOs and 99% of people on Wall Street can't get their head around. The idea that it looks more like a game of Risk rather than a game of Monopoly. But that's where we're starting to head towards. Now, to answer the Fed question, are they thinking about it? Not enough. Because let's take it just at the nuts and bolts. They don't look at the globe anywhere near enough anyway. They don't. No central bank doesn't, particularly the Fed. They've got too much internally. And they don't even understand their own economy, let alone other people. Do they listen to supply chain experts? No, they still think in a very, very linear fashion. They keep saying that. When there's a risk, but we don't see how this will go wrong. Global trade is an incredibly complicated, dynamic, non-linear system with emergent properties where things can go wrong. So you go, you know, it doesn't go like 1, 2, 3, 4. It goes 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, bankrupt, which is what we saw during COVID. And the risks are that if we get any more disruption, we could start to head in that direction. So that's one thing. And the other thing, a very, very simple point. Clearly, we're going to have some inflation from this. Some. And clearly, we've got a squeeze on the supply side. And clearly, it's not going to go away because it's geopolitical. Does it make sense to cut rates into that environment? Because when you're trying to cut rates, what are you doing? You're trying to push up demand. Is it a clever thing to try and push up demand when you have a supply squeeze? Yes or no? No.
I lean towards no.
No, exactly. So at the very least, even if you don't say to me, well, Mike, come on, are we really going to see another tightening cycle on top of the one we've already had? Are we really going to replay the 1970s? And I say, well, no. But I think you get that dynamic, nonlinear property within the current system if the market starts to think the Fed is going to cut. And again, that brings us back to where we started, which is a highly uncertain paradigm. Could be this way, could be that way. It's not going to be in the middle. But the market's saying, yeah, 6 or 7 cuts to come. As soon as the Fed alluded to the fact they might cut once. So as soon as they open that door, it's like, yeah, zero rates, here we come, right? Bitcoin, Dogecoin, diarrhea coin, every piece of crap you can think of. Let's buy all of that. Let's leverage ourselves up. That's the paradigm we've had for 40 years, during which we, you know, we had free trade, China provided us with cheap goods, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see that as the world backdrop anymore now. And the Fed have to be cognizant. And I think they've pivoted recently in their messaging and they're trying to get that across. You know, we might be able to dial it down a little bit. We might be able to go down 2 or 3 25 basis point steps from here. But it could be that 4.75 is actually a good place to rest for a while, rather than going all the way back down to 2.5 or 1.5 or 0, as everyone is salivating about. But I made the joke the other day that they're surfing away with their own saliva at the moment. And the Fed can't allow that to happen, surely.
No, it doesn't make any sense. Like, there's two follow-up questions to that. It's like, A, what does a 25 basis point drop or cut do to the economy? Like, is it even meaningful? Like, what's the point? And B, what's the signal? What's the message in general? And also, given that the EU said, well, we're not going to cut rates anytime soon, we haven't even discussed it, I think it's a bit of a race. Like, who cuts first looks like a loser, in my opinion. That's sort of the vibe I'm picking up. I might be wrong, but it feels like let's stay higher for longer, because like we're trying to protect the currency as long as we can as well, maybe, if we start cutting again. Like, first, so I'm curious if that plays a role as well. What are your two cents on that, Michael?
You are absolutely spot on. And in fact, you can even see that in New Zealand now, the RBNZ have just hinted they may have to hike again. And the RBA in Australia, you know, also an important bellwether, the market had been pricing in cut after cut, despite the fact their housing market is red hot and not getting any cooler. They're now also saying, worst comes to worst, we may have to hike again. We don't want to, but we may have to. But we still think we can cut. So watch the bellwether economies at the margin, like Australia, like New Zealand, to see if they're already having to pivot in the other direction. And I really like what you said, because you're bang on. It's not just the currency. It's also the currency, and particularly the US dollar, versus commodities. Because part of the Fed's mission, I believe, even if they won't say so and can't say so, because if they did, it's too overt and everyone would try and game it more than they do. Excuse me. Jet lag kicking in. Is to recognize that they are effectively having to keep policy tight to keep commodity prices under control. Because the supply squeezes that you've got in everything, potentially even including oil in the Middle East, although we don't think that's going to happen. That's why the market's not going crazy. They don't think Iran's going to get dragged in yet. But all the potential risks to supply that we've seen, and you know, Ukraine was a fantastic example of that, which are all there in the background. The last thing you need to do is to send the global message to everyone. Okay, so the US is running very poor foreign policy, which it is. It's militarily looking weaker and weaker and unable to even deal with a bunch of bandits like the Houthis, which is true. And now we're just going to cut rates back to zero and let everything rip with a crazy fiscal deficit. And by the way, you know, we don't expect you to all buy every commodity possible as a hedge against that. We don't think anyone will do that. I mean, I'm being sarcastic. No, this is a crazy thing. They're going to have to keep policy tighter than I think parts of the market expect as a counterfactual, which is they're not talking about it and they don't want us talking about it. But if they were to cut, that's when you'd suddenly see more commodities look like cocoa. Now, I don't think you probably look at cocoa if you're on the mining
side. Not on a daily basis.
No, okay, well, I like it a lot as a drink. But I mean, cocoa, obviously, that's got specific supply side issues just in terms of what's happening with the cocoa plantations and the difficulty getting the yield there. Nothing to do with global politics. But it's gone back up to the kind of high we last saw in the 1970s. Now, of course, if you adjust for inflation, it's far lower now than it was then. But it's shocking that we've seen that kind of swing higher. If you start mucking around with the dollar and fiscal policy and, you know, the effectiveness of the US military deterrence, all of which are being mucked around with one way or another, and then you say we're going to have low rates too, you are genuinely starting to open the door to, you know, let's say not good outcomes. And high volatility. So I think the market will find out the hard way, or the Fed will, if they don't realize this, that's what's likely to happen. So, you know, I'm guessing that you're a fan of gold.
Yes. Coming from the mining side, yes, I have to admit. I wouldn't call myself a gold bug, but I understand the reasoning for gold a lot. Being German as well, it's in my DNA. Right, with the not even 100-year-old history that we had with hyperinflation, I do understand the role of gold.
True, although just as an aside, I think you know, never forget that the real damage in Germany was done by austerity rather than hyperinflation. It was, everyone always says, "Oh, hyperinflation led to Hitler." No, it wasn't. It was Bruning's austerity that led to Hitler. Mm. So, you know, be careful what you wish for. But this is something that, you know, anyone who's looking at gold needs to pay attention to. Because while the Fed is keeping rates high, yes, gold absolutely has had a good run recently, and there's no reason why it can't do a little bit better. But if the Fed were to suddenly turn around and cut, particularly when inflation is not yet fully under control, yeah, that's a fantastic reason to be looking at gold, hypothetically. But I think the Fed is cognizant of that, and therefore you may not get that kind of move that you'd be hoping to see. But it's certainly a, you know, it's an attractive prospect if that's a market that you're in.
Well, it's always a great narrative, right? Being a gold bug or being in the gold space, there's always a doom and gloom narrative that sort of fits the bill to push gold prices higher, I have to admit. You'll always find somebody who has a good story why gold should be ripping right now. So
that's true. I mean, I'm the ironic creature that I'm called, you know, the king of doom and gloom by my friends, and yet I'm not a gold bug. I'm like, you know, if you want to get really gloomy, be gloomy and then don't back gold. And then you really understand a whole new kind of Eeyore's gloomy place all of your own.
I don't know. It's like doom and gloomers. Most of us are realists. Like we just look at facts and maybe we get scared by reality. And that's sort of, I don't know, like that's how I portray myself. I wouldn't call myself a doom and gloomer, but I'm aware of what's happening around me. Right. So well, I'm trying to connect the dots, obviously. And unfortunately, I never come to a positive conclusion. Maybe because I'm German, I have no idea. But I always end up with a negative opinion. Like, that's why on this channel, even I had the discussion before. It's like, why are we always talking about the negatives? We should be talking about why the S&P is going to 6,000 next week. Right. And not breaking down to 3,500 or something. Like, we're always looking at the negative for some reason. So, but I think, but reality dictates that. Like, I don't know, it's like the current environment just dictates more of a negative approach to things. I'm not sure if you disagree with me, but that's sort of, I don't know, I don't want to approach the podcast in that way, but it just happens because it's being dictated that way.
No, look, I completely agree. If I may, I'm just going to open my phone one here in a second in the background and just read something, because personally, I agree. I think a lot of this is hardwired in our DNA or our cultural DNA, as you were alluding to. So I don't for a second think everyone has to be or should be the same way. But, you know, you tell me if we're living in normal times, if these were a few headlines that I saw on Bloomberg over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And I was flying to the US. I'm just scrolling through on Wi-Fi in the airport. Okay, so where are we? Just going to read them through. Five or six, very quick one. Germany's days as an industrial superpower are coming to an end. Mm-hmm. One. Number two, US says Trump's Russia threat remarks to NATO allies are appalling. That's two. That's when Trump was allegedly saying, I encourage Russia to invade people who won't spend 2% of GDP on defense, which includes Germany, of course. Number three, Trump tariff threat has UN traders starting to prep for impact. Well, we discussed that, and it really would put a cat amongst the pigeons. Number four, and this is more the kind of big picture world I like spending time in, a 14th century warning for 21st century demagogues, just talking about, you know, how awful the Middle Ages were to live through. And then the last one, of course, a very good article from Niall Ferguson, who's obviously got a book to sell on the topic, to be fair, but equally it is worth reading. World War III is unimaginable. Just picture it. So that's all taken, and not with much digging. They were there high up on the list from Bloomberg yesterday. And then you say, should we be focusing only on the positives? Well, yeah, absolutely. And as I said at the beginning, you can make more money not thinking about things and doing that. But in the long run, I think looking at tipping points is more important.
Absolutely. I know the Niall Ferguson article is also trending on Bloomberg. Number one read article right now, I think. So if you think World War III is unimaginable, read this. Yeah. So I have yet to read it, I have to admit, but it's...
He doesn't make the case there's going to be a big war, by the way. He's not talking about all of us signing up and being in uniform. He's making the point that you could slip... You could see America repeat the experience of Afghanistan and the embarrassing imperial retreat from there on multiple fronts at once. You can paint a credible scenario where, for domestic political reasons, America starts to retreat from the Middle East and basically says, we're not backing Israel anymore, and, you know, let Iran basically start to dominate the region. That would be interesting for oil prices, to put it mildly, and many other things. They're also talking about China and Taiwan, and the Americans saying, well, you know, we agree that's not anything for us to get involved with. And, of course, Ukraine, and then America saying, you know, you're on your own, which could happen, you know, sooner than people think. And Europe saying, well, we've done absolutely nothing in the past 2 years other than produce lots of rhetoric. And then if that happens, then the world starts to shift without too many bullets being fired. And that's a point, actually, I've made years ago in 2018. I published a piece looking at the history of great power struggles, or the, you know, the academic work on that, and applying that to a contemporary framework, saying it looked like we were going back to a world that looked more like that, you know, period in European history where everyone was struggling against everyone, both within Europe and using whatever kind of colonial empires they had to try and, you know, leverage their position higher. And no one was really dominant for any period of time. And each time someone rose up, everyone kind of combined to try and bring them down. And, it, you know, there are lessons that you can draw from that. But the one thing I got wrong in that is I thought that the argument would be whoever had the lower interest rate would be winning in that environment, which actually is true in the long run. If you've got a lower cost of borrowing, you can build a bigger military machine. You can be stronger for longer, and you win. And I still think there is some dynamic to that. But right now, because of this US dollar commodity complex dynamic I've just been describing, actually, I think it suits America to have a higher interest rate, and the fact that they can wear it for longer. So America might be able to say, you know what, we can stick around the 5% level for a while. Europe can't. Australia can't. New Zealand can't. China is already cutting. Let all that capital flow out from the East. Come to daddy. Come to Uncle Sam.
I mentioned energy prices earlier. I think that's a big part of it in the 21st century. Like, if you take the Middle Ages out of it, there was no energy policy, really. But now like, if you look at what I'm paying for power here in Germany is 40 cents a kilowatt hour, while the US and a friend of mine in Utah pay 7 cents a kilowatt hour. You can't tell me that there's an unfair advantage. Like, he could be mining Bitcoin profitably while I'm losing money left, right, and center. Just an example, for example. Right?
Yeah, I hope none of you are. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just right. So, but there's a massive disconnect, obviously. And that's sort of the first article you mentioned, that the German industrial complex is completely falling apart. That's part of that, I think. So, Michael, like, phenomenal conversation. I could go on for hours with you. This is fantastic. We just opened a whole new can of worms here, because energy policy, ESG-driven energy policies to a degree, ESG-driven investment demand to a degree as well, and how that is shifting again. It's probably a topic for part 2, 3, and 4 of a conversation here. So, but I truly appreciate your time, Michael. I know you're traveling right now as well. So, and you mentioned jet lag earlier. So highly appreciative of your time. Where can we find more of your work? Where can we follow you? You got your Twitter handle, I think, in your title here as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, obviously, most of my work is for, you know, my Rabo clientele, but I'm quoted in the media quite frequently. And please check out both my LinkedIn and my Twitter or X handle below. And, you know, happy to continue the conversation with anyone who wants to.
Fantastic. No, we'll definitely have to chat in Q2 again, Michael. We haven't even talked about the banking crisis, commodities I want to spend a bit more time on next time. Just because I think there's a lot to discuss and so much going on. Like you just with oil, I think we could spend a whole episode just discussing how the oil market is working to a degree. Fantastic. Michael, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. And everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. I tremendously enjoyed this episode here with Michael Avery. And if you did as well, please leave a like so that we know that, A, we've asked the right questions. We brought the right guest on. It just gives us fantastic feedback. Leave a comment down below as well. What do you think of our guest? What do you think of me of asking questions? I have to admit, I watched the Super Bowl, the first half of the Super Bowl last night, so a bit discombobulated early on. But really appreciate your patience with me here as well. Thank you so much for following, and we'll be back with lots more this week. Thank you so much.